Shabbat, Hanumanta, everybody, because I just thought that I saw Shri Shimana's divine grace. They see Bhakti Vedanta Goswami Maharaj, Shri Prabhupada, Ki Jai. Jayam Vishnupad, Hanumahansa, Paribhaja, Gacharja, Sto, Tarasar, Shri Shri, Manas, the Vangra, Shri Bhakti, Siddhanta, Saraswati, Thakur, Maharaj, Shri Prabhupada, Ki Jai. Anantakoti, Vaishnava, Rinda, Ki Jai. ISKCON, Founder, Acharya, Shri Prabhupada, Ki Jai. Namacharya, Shri Haridas, Thakur, Ki Jai. Prem, Sagahosi, Krishna, Chaitanya, Prabhu, Nityananda, Shri Advaita, Gadara, Shri Vasadi, Gaur, Bhakta, Rinda, Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopi Gopina Sham Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai. Shri Shri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Navadvip Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Mayapur Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Mathura Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai. Shri Shri Ayodhya Dham Ki Jai. Tulasi Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Gangamaya Ki Jai. Jamanamaya Ki Jai. Gaur Premanandi, Harinama Sankirtan Ki Jai. Shri Shri Brihat Madanga Ki Jai. Transcendental Prasadam Distribution Ki Jai. Shri Shri Gornitai Ki Jai. Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Madana Mohanna Ki Jai. Shri Shri Nuhastanapura Dham Ki Jai. Shamaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga. Hare Krishna. So today we're reading from the 10 offenses, the 26 qualities of a devotee. 10 offenses are included in these. And today we're going to talk about two offenses, akama and aniha. Akama is desirelessness, and aniha, Prabhupada translates as indifferent to material acquisitions. Akama, aniha, sthira vijita sadguna. So akama, kama means desires, and akama means without material desires. There's the famous verse, akama, mokshakama va. The implication is that moksha kama udhari, akama, sarva kama, but whether one is full of material desires, or whether one is free from all material desires, if one engages in the process of bhakti yoga, tivena bhakti yoga na, because bhakti yoga is so powerful, so extremely powerful, jiveta purusham param, that one will become advanced in the path of liberation, and that one will actually become attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in this case, desirelessness means no material hankering. It means that we not are absent of desire. As it's often said, our movement does not stop desire, but it redirects, or as Prabhupada used the word, dovetails desire. Desire can't be stopped. Desire is the natural condition of the living being, and in fact to enjoy is the natural condition of all living beings, liberated or not liberated, in the spiritual world or the material world. The human condition, or the condition of all living entities, human or non-human, is the enjoying spirit. Prabhupada gave the example once of an ant. It can sense that there is a grain of sugar on top of a skyscraper, and it will go up the skyscraper to find that grain of sugar. So it's not limited to human beings. Animals, the vulture can also see from thousands and thousands of feet, can spot its prey. Its eyes are very, very sharp. And its sense of pleasure is to enjoy through eating. So this desire is in animals sometimes more advanced than those in humans. The sense of smell of the dog, the sight of the vulture, the ability to sense sweets by the ends. Very strong, very powerful. So these are desires, and they're all material desires. And because it's so much an integral part of the condition of all living entities, it can't be forgotten, it can't be artificially repressed. Freud's hypothesis was based on the idea of repression, that you can't repress desires. And it's also part of the Bhagavad Gita's teaching, Vishayavini Vartante, Niraha Rasya Dehinaha, Rasovabhyam Rasopyasya, Param Vishvam Nivartate, that if one doesn't actually get a transcendental higher taste, then desire for sense gratification will remain in the heart. And one simply will pretend not to desire. Desire is always there, it's never taken away. Therefore, we find that many so-called meditators and jnanis, although apparently desireless in their meditations or in their austerities and renunciations, are actually having desires deeply buried within the heart that they have not eradicated. And they come back, they manifest themselves, and cause them to fall from their position of so-called renunciation. So Prabhupada often gave the example of impersonalist, so-called realized souls, who after many years of this type of meditation find themselves coming back from the Himalayas or from their austerities in the forest or wherever to engage in welfare work, mundane welfare work like building hospitals and so on, because they haven't actually had a transcendental taste. So in one sense, we can say that there's an inverse ratio between renunciation and spiritual advancement. It's said in the Bhagavad Gita, Bhogaishvarya prasaktanam taya prakriti chetasam vyavasayat mikabodhir samado navidiyate, that if one remains attached or anchored to material things in this material world, even though one's practicing some form of spiritual life or spiritual advancement, resolute determination to engage in devotional service does not take place in the heart of such a person. So the phrase vyavasayat mikabodhir is there in that verse. That means with very single-pointed, one-minded intelligence. This is another way of saying great determination. Determination is very hard to come by in the material world except for a determination to enjoy the senses in every possible way. There are myriad ways that have been invented in Kali Yuga to enjoy the senses, to fulfill every desire. For example, one can see that by holding a little remote control module, one can course through 50 or 80 or 100 different television channels, each offering a different form of material enjoyment, of desire. Desires in the animal kingdom are generally a bit limited to eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, and maybe a few other things. But human beings with a more advanced brain have many, many desires. They have not just four or five or six, but they have 10, 100, thousands, actually millions of desires. Some of the modern computers advertise that they can make combinations of millions of different colors by mixing the different basic three colors, yellow, blue, and green. Is that what they are, the basic ones? Mm-hmm. And from that, it expands, just like the three modes of nature. These three modes of nature expand in the same way, 3, 9, 81, and so on. And these are our desires. They're based on these different modes, and they're all mixed in all these different permutations and combinations. And they're actually unlimited. So sometimes we hear about unlimited desire. It doesn't necessarily mean that desire is just unlimited. It has no cessation. There's no full sense of being surfeited by desire. But it also means that for a human being with a more developed brain, material brain, the desires are unlimited. And in Kali Yuga especially, mass marketing has pandered to the whims of all these desires. For every desire, almost, you can say, there's a product or a service, some form of enjoyment that can handle that desire, that can fulfill that desire. A spiritualist tries to see the difference between material and spiritual desire, and a bhakta or a Vaishnava learns the art of putting those desires into the form of bhakti or developing them for Krishna. The desires also are sometimes manifested by sin, or sometimes it's synonymous to say sinful activity, sinful desires. Desires are the root of the sinful activity. Everything proceeds in our philosophy from subtle to gross. We learned that the creation was conceived of by Lord Brahma, ultimately by Lord Krishna. But by meditation and conception, there was an understanding of how the whole universe would be done, how it would be created, and how it would be manifested. In the material world, that same principle holds true. An engineer or a designer thinks how to do it, and then every aspect of the construction is printed out in a blueprint. It's all written down, or in writing a script for a movie. Every scene, every camera angle, every color is completely thought out in the mind of the writer or the producer. And then once it's all written down, as with the engineer's drawings, the thing, the drawing, the building, or the movie, it very easily, quickly becomes manifest because the thought pattern is already there. These manifestations of desires are sinful because there's no spiritual intelligence. So these are different forms of sinful activity that we see in the material world. And they come from desires. These desires are sometimes compared to seeds. I'm going to read a little paragraph from Nectar Devotion, which Rupa Goswami very nicely describes these desires. He's quoting from the Padma Purana, where there are four kinds of effects due to sinful activities. In the ensuing paragraph, I'll just read ahead a little bit, he says that those effects described are as, quote, almost mature, end quote, referred to the distress from which one is suffering at present, and the effects, quote, lying as seed, end quote, means that in the core of the heart there is a certain stock of sinful desires which are like seeds. So this means that it's not so much, it is of course that it's the reaction, it's a karmic reaction, and the laws of nature are acting upon us. But these reactions are also sometimes manifested, or they can be described in terms of desire. There's a desire to have a beautiful home. Or there's a desire to have sex life. Or there's a desire to be a great person. Or there's a desire to excel, to be a great sportsman or some literateur. From the material point of view, these desires are there in many of the minds of the living beings in this material world, the human souls. But they are sometimes unknown, or they're as it's mentioned here, they're lying as seed, or unfructified, or in an immature or unmanifested state. It's the duty of Vaishnavas to find these things that are buried. They're sometimes buried, and our experience has been sometimes we see that even though people progress apparently very well on the path of devotional service, do a lot of service, a lot of actual tangible service, perform many different Vedic functions, and act according to Vaishnava etiquette, and speak very nicely, make lots of devotees. After a long time, sometimes even after 10, 20, or 30 years or more, even after performing so much devotional service, these very deeply buried desires that haven't manifested and haven't been confronted by deep internal introspection bewilder even such a person, and they are sometimes, these things are sometimes described as weeds. The devotional creeper which brought all these things about is growing apparently very robust and very strong, but as we know, the metaphor of the garden is that you can plant a beautiful, beautiful garden. We were talking about this the other day at one of our board meetings, that you plant the flowers and they look so beautiful, but there's a tremendous amount of energy required to keep that flower bed free of weeds, because the weeds just keep growing and growing and growing. So it takes a lot of maintenance. So the devotional creeper is like that. It's being attacked at every moment by desires, material desires. And the metaphor has been given of a creeper. If you ever walk down by the Potomac River, you'll see all the trees, most of them, they're encircled by these creepers. So the analogy is there that the devotional plant or creeper, it can grow and be very strong, but it can be strangulated. It can be completely devoured. There's a type of tree that grows around another tree. It's a parasite, and it actually devours the inner tree after some time, and it takes over. And it's like a ghost inhabiting the psyche of somebody. It actually happens. And these desires are kind of like that. They're kind of like ghosts, which we're all very afraid of. They're very powerful beings. And they, in certain instances, they can actually inhabit a person's psyche and completely take over and cause a person to act and do things they would not ordinarily ever do. So these desires are sometimes compared to that they sort of take over, even in an advanced stage. And then all of the so-called advancement seems to kind of disappear, at least temporarily. It goes away, like the disciplic succession. It's broken, and then it kind of fades out and disappears. Or like a lake or a river, it kind of dissipates over a field. It appears to disappear, although the water is actually still there. So the desire for Krishna consciousness is still there, but because of the insidious effect of these material desires, that just kind of spring up. We don't even know sometimes where they come from. It's like we don't know how we got into this material world exactly. And they envelop and sometimes inhabit the living being. It's said that the living being who is infested with offenses or material desires, who is overwhelmed by such things, not only cannot engage in devotional service with resolute determination, but is also compared to being like a person haunted by a ghost. That's one of the analogies Prabhupada gives very often. A person who is not transcendentally conscious is victimized by all desires, and therefore just like a madman. Madman means one who doesn't speak anything intelligent or intelligible, doesn't know where he's going, doesn't know what he's doing, doesn't know where he came from. He's just wandering about like all these cars zipping up and down the beltway 70-80 miles an hour. Where are they going? What are they doing? They're going so fast. But, you know, as far as if you asked any one of those persons, what's your goal in life, very few of them would be able to give a clear idea. They're just trying to sort of, you know, make more money, get by, and as Prabhupada says so often, just work hard all day, go home and have a little sex at night, turn on a tube and eat something, and that's it. So when one's overwhelmed by desire, just like a madman, if you compare this to people living in an insane asylum, sanatorium, they're just walking around, kind of, you know, aimlessly. You don't know what they're doing. You don't know where they're going. When they speak, it doesn't make any sense. So from a transcendentalist point of view, when people in the material world speak without any fixation on spiritual life, it doesn't make any sense. What am I saying? What am I doing? I'm, you know, adding the columns in the finances, making projections for the management meeting, and this and that. But, you know, really without a transcendental purpose, it doesn't mean anything. It's just, sometimes I notice the people on the airplanes, they're writing down their figures, and they all just look so, like the plane's going somewhere, but where are they going? They don't really seem to have a clear, just sort of, you know, getting by, you know, walking through life in a daze. What was the existentialist say? Everyone's living a life of quiet desperation. Kierkegaard, one of those. I remember reading that when I was young. Quiet desperation. It's not like, you know, everyone's real quiet sitting on the bus or the subway. They don't talk to each other. But they're all very desperate inside, all full of anxiety, full of material desires that can't be fulfilled. And that's another reason why it's kind of like a ghost, because the ghost it doesn't have a material body, and he can't fulfill his desires. He's always frustrated, always angry, always causing trouble, because he's got desires, but he can't fulfill. There's no bodily organs to fulfill those desires. So that's the nature of everyone in this material world. They're trying to fulfill the desires, but they can't. Kama krodha lobha moha. So, you know, it leads to frustration, leads to anger, leads to envy, and then everything worthwhile is actually lost. So it's the duty of a transcendentalist to try to search very deeply, sometimes to use the analogy reaming out of the mind and the heart these desires that are in seed form. And as Rupa Goswami gives another metaphor, these seeds can be fried. When you fry a seed in the oven, it becomes impotent. It cannot fructify. So that's the idea. They're there, but they have to be, the material desires, they need to be fried. Sometimes we say fried. That's the thing that should be fried, our material desires. They have to be identified, recognized, and one way to fry them is to engage them in the Lord's service. Rupa Goswami is imploring us. To be attached to everything connected with Krishna and be aloof from everything that is not connected with Krishna, then this is renunciation. Just like we see in some intelligent people, they're kind of, when they're devotees, they renounce. We drove this one man to the airport the day before. This was yesterday. And he's one of the three or four richest families. He's the eldest of one of these families. So wealthy, we can't imagine. And after we dropped him off, he bowed down on the street, touched his forehead to the floor in the airport in front of everybody. So that's a detachment. It's not that if one has a lot of wealth or a lot of good karma, that disqualifies one automatically. One can be surrounded by wealth, and still, by detachment, one can be very advanced. One can be desireless. And of course, that's more difficult, but one can actually be desireless. So when we see sometimes these great souls like the Goswamis, and we see how they lived, we understand that they were living because they were very attached to Krishna. When we read about Raghunath Goswami living on a little pat of butter every day, or a little buttermilk, and sleeping sometimes 2 hours, sometimes no hours every night, it's inconceivable. And of course, we can't imitate these great Goswamis. They're all really incarnations of gopis. We can't even imagine who they are. But they exhibited, at least for us to understand, that a human being can live very simply. It can be done. Once I was on a train in India, and we came to a station, stopped for a while. Sometimes those a whiles can go on to 2 or 3 hours, but this was about a 10-minute stop. And on the platform right opposite my window, there were two men talking. One was maybe about, looked to be about 60 years old. He was gray-haired, and they each had a book, and they were engaged in this very animated conversation. The other one was a lot younger. His hair was black. They were both very thin, and they were sitting on these little gumshoes. So they were kind of talking from their books. They were obviously some kind of mendicants reading from shastras. And they were talking, and then at one point they shook hands, and the young, very thin man stood up, and he gathered up a few belongings he had and tied them up in this cloth, this gumshoe he was sitting on, then tied it to a stick and slung it over his shoulder, you know, like you see sometimes in pictures, and just got up and walked away with a big smile on his face. And the other man kind of did the same thing, wrapped up his book and his few belongings, and he went his way. These are the people I was remembering. They were happy, very happy expressions on their faces. They weren't feeling that they were bereft of, you know, material things. So their desires were very simple. And I was thinking how wonderful it is in this country. There's so many people who their desires in life are very simple. They have some desire for spiritual life. In our situation, we can't imitate or hope to be like them because we're living in a world that's surrounded by material things. But it was just the spirit of renunciation. It was so nice and so simple to think that one can live in a very simple way with very few desires. It was very inspiring. Many of Lord Chaitanya's followers were like that. Many of them were householders, many of them were not householders, but they all lived very simply, and this pleased Mahaprabhu very much. When Sanatana Goswami gave that blanket, you know the famous story where he would become a renunciant, a mendicant, but he had this beautiful blanket. When he gave it away to a very poor man and came back to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because he didn't say anything. He didn't say, I don't like that blanket. He just saw the way he was looking at it, that he didn't like the blanket. So when he gave it away, then Mahaprabhu was very pleased. He mentioned, that's very nice. He could see he was very happy. And that was his last bit of material desire, just gone away. So sometimes they're a little difficult to notice our material desires. Prabhupada also translates the word ahoitaki in that famous verse, Savai Pum Samparodamo, yantra bhakti hoksaje. Hoitaki apratiyata yayatmam supersedati. That devotional service, in order to completely satisfy the self, must be unmotivated. Or it's very important that in maturity, in spiritual life, one doesn't have what we call ulterior motives. So that's another example of kama mishra bhakti, or bhakti that's mixed, or where there's some desire that's not fulfilled, that's being maintained. So this verse says that in devotional service, in order to be successful, in order to please the Supreme Lord, must be both uninterrupted, apratiyata, and ahoitiki, unmotivated, or without any material desire mixed in. Ultimately, material desire has to become absent. So these are some of the thoughts about what desires are and how they can be controlled. In our Krishna consciousness movement, generally we try to control desire. Prabhupada said, if you have to have children, have 100 children, but make them all devotees. Then that desire becomes purified. So the next quality of a devotee is aniha. Prabhupada describes indifferent to material acquisitions. Generally, material acquisitions, I'm sorry, I was just going to read this one last paragraph in the Nectar Devotion on Desires. This is just the enumeration of the four desires. It's stated in Padma Purana that there are four kinds of effects due to sinful activities, which are listed as follows. One, the effect which is not yet fructified. Two, the effect which is lying as seed. Three, the effect which is already mature. And four, the effect which is almost mature. It is also stated that all these four effects become immediately vanquished for those who surrender unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, and become engaged in his devotional service in full consciousness. Archita Prabhu was talking about this yesterday, how when one engages in devotional service, these desires are burned away, because Krishna is ultimately regulating all the comings and goings, all the positions of all the living beings. And it's also mentioned in Brahma Samhita, Yastvindra Gopa Mata Vendra Mahosva Karma Bandana Rupam Palabha Dana Matanoti Karmani Nirdahati Kintucha Bhakti Bhajam Govindamari Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. Because Krishna himself is regulating the activities of all living beings all over the universe. If one becomes attached to Krishna and offers his devotion to him, Karmani Nirdahati Kintucha Bhakti Bhajam, then all of his sinful karma will be burned away. Devotional service has the power to burn away devotional service from Brahma himself down to the Indragopa germ. And devotional service can burn away more sinful activities than we can commit. However, it doesn't mean that just because of these truths that everything will happen automatically. If I only chant all my and follow the principles, then everything will automatically go away. And I mentioned this when I first talked about the different 26 qualifications of a devotee. There was that verse that precedes this one, yas-yasti bhakti bhagavatya kinchana, that automatically it says that, not automatically, but it says that the devotee, by rendering transcendental, yes it does say, I'm sorry, automatically, by rendering transcendental devotional service to Krishna, one automatically performs all subsidiary activities. This confident, firm faith, favorable to the discharge of devotional service, is called Shraddha. So from that point of view, it appears that if we have complete and firm faith, then all qualities, all these 26 qualities, will become manifest. And certainly, we see that those who engage in devotional service, without being even aware maybe of the 26 qualities, we see that these qualities begin to become manifest. People become gentle, they become kind, they become reduced in their material desires. But the point is that devotional service is a process. It's a procedure. It's not something that you have it and then that's it. It's over. Therefore, these qualifications are mentioned. And even though there's a certain automatic, what does it actually mean? Auto means self-motion. There's a certain auto and matic. It means that there's a self-motion towards this. But it doesn't mean that we're automatically going to get to the goal. And therefore, as I mentioned, these weeds have to be very vigilantly watched for. When one is an absolutely pure devotee, then these qualities are automatically there. So this verse refers to one who is becoming a pure devotee. So indifferent to material desire, aniha, this is the principle, also it overlaps a little bit with the idea of understanding what our desires are. If one has desires but becomes detached from them, or indifferent, this is a very nice word, indifferent. Another word in English is oblivious. Sometimes it's misunderstood, it's not caring, but it actually means just, you know, indifferent, doesn't matter. So the body is a fountainhead, a veritable fountainhead of pains and desires. And it's actually driving us at every moment, as are our minds. I see something, oh, I want to just see it. I hear it's a beautiful sound, I just want to just completely immerse myself in that hearing. I want to wallow in this beautiful Mozart or heavy metal or whatever it is that happens to push my buttons for enjoyment. I just want to just zone out and enjoy. So indifference means that one's actually walking through this material world, like we read of the lives of great souls, and it just doesn't compute, it doesn't impinge on the mind, it's not interested. Disinterested is another way to describe indifference. It's not hatred, it's not desire, because we know that hatred's the other side of desire. But he's indifferent. Prahlad Maharaj was often cited as a great example. He was put in all sorts of difficult conditions, and he was indifferent. And sometimes we find, too, when we're put in a difficult condition, and we just try to remember Krishna and sort of put it out of our minds or not get too worried about it. And then Krishna sort of comes forth and saves us when we remember him. Now, we've all had that experience, I'm sure, sometime. You're in a very dangerous spot with your car and you Hare Krishna, and somehow, you know, the guy pulls out in time and you don't hit him. So that's another form of indifference. If it's smarter, really, if one remembers Krishna, especially in times of difficulty and distress, it's easy to see how that indifference has actually saved us. That we weren't able to save ourselves by ourselves, but because we depended on Krishna to help us, we became a little disinterested, detached, indifferent, and therefore we were able to succeed by depending more on Krishna. So the things that generally people are attached to, material acquisitions, are stated in the Bhagavatam, Janmaishvarya Shruti Shivir, birth, that's good karma, so to speak, wealth, learning, and beauty. These are things that is so almost inescapable. You know, if you have a good birth, if you have wealth, if you have bodily beauty, good education, you're attached to it. It's almost unavoidable. When one becomes a devotee, in fact, it's said that if one is trying to advance in these things along this path, then one can actually vibrate the holy name with feeling. On the other hand, when one begins to get a transcendental taste for transcendental austerities, which in this case is mainly chanting of the holy name, then one forgets. One becomes indifferent to all these things. And as I was mentioning about this gentleman, very wealthy man, flies around the world first class, has thousands of people working for him. But for him to bow down in front of hundreds of people to a sannyasi, it doesn't matter. He doesn't care what people think. That's indifference. It's very hard to be indifferent. It's very hard not to think that I'm more intelligent than somebody else, so you know I can do everything better than someone else. Very hard not to think that because I have a good education that I actually understand and know things better than people who don't have such an education. It's very difficult. Or if I'm very beautiful, very handsome, or very attractive, it's very hard for me not to look down my nose at other people who don't seem to be so attractive. It's very hard because we're all very, by nature, we're here because we're very proud. We're proud of everything. And it's said that the pauper is proud of his penny. So it doesn't matter whether we're rich, poor, educated or uneducated, beautiful or not beautiful, we're very proud. So one has to practice becoming indifferent in any condition of life. It's very difficult. There's kind of an amazing phenomenon. We just drove for 12 hours from Florida, 14 hours. So when you're in a car for 12 hours, you begin to develop a little bit of car consciousness and start to think you start to notice how people identify with their cars. Somebody's got a red car, that's usually a very extroverted person, you know, very flashy type. And then this person driving gray and brown cars, they're usually a little more introverted. But in any case, people identify so much with their cars. You know, if they're the kind of people who are very passionate, it just comes out immediately in the way they drive. or if they're out of control, their senses are out of control, they may be drinking, but they just don't drive intelligently. They drive very dangerously because they're out of control, whether they're intoxicated or not. They just have no control over their minds. They're probably thinking about something a million miles away, and the next thing you know, boing, they're dead because they didn't notice that there was a red light in front of them or something. In 1 second. So when one is attached to the car, to the home, you know, everyone around here, I'm sure, is very attached to their home. Prabhupada says they have to come back sometimes as ghosts and live in that house, or as a cockroach and live in the same house. It's very common in some of these old ancestral gentry, landed gentry homes in England. We used to see some. We had some experience, actually, that people have lived in these family homes for years and years and years, and they're haunted. They're actually, you know, haunted houses, because the ancestors have been so attached to that house, living there, so attached that they're probably meditating on it at the time of death, and they're hanging around in some ghostly form for eons, who knows how long. But a transcendentalist is also detached. It's very easy to get attached, sometimes with the computers. You know, I know people that have a new fancy computer and they start playing video games day after day on it. Or they just get into all the dazzling things that a color computer can do, and they just spend hours and hours, you know, getting distracted from devotional service by, you know, this is just little game type things. So in every step, it's said in the material world, padam padam yad vipadam natesham, there is danger. And sometimes this danger is very subtle. It's the danger of just becoming attached to almost anything that one does, even in devotional service, and becoming materially attached. And when that happens, our devotional service, which is meant to be devotional service, it can deteriorate into karmic activity. And that we have seen. We have seen very successful people in our movement rise to a very high position, and then because they got attached to something, maybe it was a big house, whatever, then Krishna took everything away, and it started all over again. Back to square one, as they say. Anyway, those are some thoughts on indifferentness and desirelessness. So maybe someone would like to comment further as it's 8:35. Yes?
You're talking about the sink of desire, that after many years of being a devotee, even a bank devotee could be thrown off by this fructification of the sink of desire that's been sitting there dormant. At the time of initiation, I was under the impression that your karma is taken by Krishna and the Guru.
Mm-hmm.
It seems as though we're working towards, with the four regular principles, we're working towards not having desire. So after we renounce the four regular principles, or the acceptable regular principles, renouncing the opposite,
yeah.
Isn't the